Thanks. It's a pleasure to be introduced by Anna because those two classes changed my life. That's when I saw the light, in fact, all thanks to you. So, to algorithms and beyond. How many people here are not from the rigidity workshop? So I get a sense of who's here. Okay, so it's going to be about half and half. It's fun, just like last lecture, we have a mix of different backgrounds, I'm guessing. So today is about it's in the spirit of folding. So yesterday had a lot of origami. Today we're going to be folding more one-dimensional structures, things like robotic arms, which Rigidity Conference is talking about a lot. And it's going to get to proteins, and there's this famous mathematician, Erdős. I'll start out with just a little bit of motivation. If you haven't thought about folding one-dimensional structures before, a lot of this world comes originally from mechanical engineering. Back before electrical engineering, mechanics was the big thing. It's actually a big thing again these days. But in the 1700s, 1800s, there's a lot of interesting mechanical structures. These days, robotics, graphics, you want to animate your character in Toy Story 7. And so you want to the animator typically makes a couple of poses, and then the computer has to fill in that animation in between. This keyframe animation. How do you fold? You model your character maybe by one-dimensional structures plus some muscles and skin. How do you animate that underlying structure? In biology, if you could figure out how proteins fold, maybe you could cure all the world's diseases. So that's the kind of motivation we're thinking about. A lot of this talk, though, is going to be about the underlying geometry of these structures, although I will get to protein folding a little bit. In general, here's an example of a linkage. So we think of our frameworks, and this is in 3D. A lot of the time we'll also be working in 2D. You have these rigid rods. You can think of them as made of metal or plastic or whatever. And then you have flexible joints, which are not really represented graphically here, but they're just attachments. Wherever you would bring these rods together, they have to stay attached. And then you're allowed to flex this thing in any way that preserves the length of these edges and keeps everything that's supposed to be connected. Incidentally, this is a design by my father, Martin Demain. If anyone knows how to build this, I would love to know. As a kinetic sculpture, I'd love to have your feedback. It's unfortunately not 1 degree of freedom, as you probably figured out, but I would love to actually build this motion. Okay, so that's the world, and I want to talk about a lot of different topics in this kind of genre, and they're organized by sort of old math, recent math, and future math, I guess you might say. So past, present, and future. So you'll see a little bit more what that means. I'm going to start with two sort of old results and sort of recent directions in those old results. So in the beginning, people were building locomotive engines and wanted to move trains around. And so there's this problem of how do you take a linear motion that's made by a steam piston and convert it into a circular motion that you want to turn your wheels, because circular wheels seem good. So how do we do this sort of linear to circular motion? Can you do it by a purely mechanical device? And this is the topic of this book by Kemp, How to Draw a Straight Line. You may know how to draw a straight line. But this is how to draw a straight line by turning a circular crank. And it has all sorts of great practical applications, like moving your candles around. And I haven't read a lot of the book, but it has two linkages in particular. I'll highlight an early one from 1784 by Watt. You may have heard of Watt because he's a unit. And he came up with this. He was more proud of this linkage than any other mechanical invention he made, and he had hundreds and hundreds of innovations in steam mechanics. So it's quite a statement. It doesn't quite make a line, but you see you have three rigid bars and they're pinned at the ends, and this green point moves along this figure eight curve, and if you just use it in this portion, that figure eight is pretty straight. It's not completely straight, so you lose a little bit of the energy from the shear, but it's reasonable. And this actually did improve steam engines a lot. The first sort of fully correct motion that makes a straight line out of a circular motion here is the Poissonier inverser from about 100 years later. We have another unit here, Lord Kelvin. And he was playing around with one of them. and someone went to say, hey, can I play with it? Said, no, I've not had nearly enough of it. It's the most beautiful thing I've ever seen in my life. So you see what kind of entertainment they had back then. It's very cool. And so that's drawing straight lines. Kemp is also pretty interesting at various levels. I really like this book of his. You can read it for free in Google Books. It's out of copyright. In the mathematics world, he's quite well known as having a proof attempt, let's say, at the famous four-color theorem that you can color every map with four colors. It's famous because the technique that he introduced is actually the technique that's used for both proofs of the four-color theorem today. He just missed a few hundred cases, but he had over 100 cases, and it's sort of the structure is right for a correct proof, but it took 100 years to sort of really nail it and check everything. But I like his linkage work, and in particular, there's this thing called Kemp's universality theorem, which he also didn't prove, but he gave the structure of a proof. And the informal statement of the theorem is that there's a linkage to sign your name. So there's some big linkage, kind of like the Poissier things that we saw. There's one circular crank. You turn the crank, in principle, and it can sign your name or write a word or whatever. And so there's one pen on one of the vertices. The sense of signing your name here is that you can make a finite portion of a polynomial curve. If you know what polynomials are, cool, you'll be happy with this. Otherwise, it's a nice curve, let's say. And any curve can be approximated by a polynomial. There's a claim of this result in this paper in 1877 by Kemp, but it took a lot of other mathematicians to actually prove it, because his original proof had a problem. Let me give you a sketch of the problem and some ways to fix it. So one of the cool things he built was a way to trisect an angle, another famous problem in mathematics. So here's a mechanical linkage. I don't know if this is a rendering or a photograph of an actual one that he built, but this is from his paper. It's got a bunch of things joined together. You've got, see here, three copies of the same angle, and so if you, and this structure is flexible, you can fold it to any angle, and then you just measure that, and that's one-third of your angle. So you can trisect any angle with this mechanical device. You can divide any angle by any integer, in fact. And this works great, unless you collapse everything down to zero. If you get down to an angle of zero, you have, let me highlight, one of the pieces of the structure is what's called a contraparallelogram. So you've got sort of A, B structure, and it's crossing itself. And in this world, things can slide over other bars. And so you have this problem here I have the analog of a parallelogram. When you collapse a parallelogram flat like this, so I'm taking this guy and collapsing it flat, then it can pop open to a contraparallelogram. And that's kind of annoying, because also if you have a contraparallelogram, you can fold it back to a parallelogram, and so things sort of break. So what Kemp showed is that he built a linkage that can follow the desired curve, but it can do other things too, and you have to remove those things. And there are ways to do it, is the short version. This is I presented this partial proof in a class, this geometric folding algorithms class that's online now, but this is back in 2004. And I said, hey, is there any easy way to fix this proof? Because all the other proofs use different gadgets, different constructions. And it turns out this is an easy way. I'm not going to prove it. If you add a point way far away and connect it with these bars to the midpoints of these edges, and that will force a contraparallelogram to stay contra. Funny adjective. And so that was sort of an easy way to fix Kemp's proof, and it's in our book. That was originally for pedagogical purposes, but we were kind of bored and, we wanted more results, so we proved some other things using that technique. King originally proved that you can not just make one polynomial, but you can sort of chain together a bunch of polynomials. And if you've ever used a drawing program and drawn curves, you've made splines, and that's essentially what you can get out of this. In general, semi-algebraic sets, but in particular, if you want one-dimensional things, you get splines. So that's nice. That's a really good way to sign your name. Because we're algorithms people, we computed how many edges, how many bars do you need to make a degree n polynomial in d dimensions? And we've proved upper and lower bounds, say n to the d is the right answer. And then for the rigidity people, I'm not going to go through the proof of this, but we confirmed this sort of conjecture or, you know, sort of belief that's been around for a while, that testing rigidity of a given linkage, if I give you a linkage, I want to know, can it move at all? This is something, it's called co-NP-hard, which means computationally intractable. There's no good algorithm to solve it. It's not too surprising, but to prove it, you need to be very careful about, because co-NP is very specific, you need to be careful about, can you build this construction with a polynomial number of bits? If you know what that means, cool, otherwise, don't worry. So we did that, and this is in Tim Abbott's thesis right now. It hasn't actually been published, my fault, but it will be eventually. If you want to read it, though, his thesis is online. Cool. So that was a little tour of the Kempe world. I want to go to another old problem posed by Paul Erdős, the most famous mathematician of our time, maybe ever. I don't know. I'm a big fan, though I sadly never got to meet him. And he, early on in his career, I think he was a student at this point, he posed this problem, 1934. I give you a polygon, so it's in two dimensions, and I take what's called the convex hull. I wrap the polygon in an elastic membrane, take the smallest convex polygon that contains everything here, and I get these regions in between the polygon and the hull, which we call pockets, these pink things, and I take one of them, I forget the order here, and I flip it outside. Imagine I pull this point out of the plane and drop it back down on the other side, and so this whole thing ends up getting reflected through the dashed line. And so I keep doing that for each pocket. I have a new hull, I flip another pocket, I have a new hull, I flip another pocket, I have a new hull, I flip another pocket, this one down here, new hull, pocket. Eventually, if I ever get something that's convex, I think this is almost convex. There's a little sliver here which will flip out. I don't think I have that animated. But once it's convex, you're done. There's no more pockets. So the question is, is it always the case that you are eventually done? Does this finish after finitely many flips? It's not so clear. And so this was originally in the Monthly, American Mathematical Monthly. This is the entire paper by Paul Erdős. It's a paragraph. It's a problem. I'm not super familiar with what this problem series was supposed to be like at the time. I'm guessing he had an answer, but as far as I know, no one asked him whether he had an answer. He says, prove that after a finite number of steps, you will get a convex polygon. Okay, I'm rephrasing it, is it finite to make it more tense? But the answer is yes, it is always finite. He actually posed the problem slightly differently, so there's this subtlety that he said, when you take the convex hull and you get these pockets, flip all of the pockets simultaneously. We'll get to that. And the reason this is connected to linkage folding is you can think of it going through three dimensions. But you can also just think of it as a planar reflection. So let's see, that was 34 and 39, so 5 years later, Nagy had this paper. This is about a page and a half. There it is, in case you want to read it. It's a little small. And he had 2 points. One is that if you flip all pockets simultaneously, you might get intersections. So here's a polygon with two pockets. When you flip them, they intersect, and his example is basically the same. So that's bad, and so we instead just flip one pocket at a time, and that always that guarantees you never get crossings like that. And he had a fairly short and reasonably simple, the little terse proof that every polygon convexifies after finitely many flips. So this was in 1939, before the internet, and so it was a little hard for people to know that this was actually a proved theorem, and so it was actually rediscovered many times. So I think Reshetnyak and Yusupov did it at the same time. I don't know how this is possible. Presumably they both heard it from a common person, but they don't say who. And then Kazarinov and Bing. Wegener, Kaluza posed it completely independently. It's a natural problem. You're fooling around with polygons. It's a cool thing to do. We actually independently did it, I think, in 1998. But before we published anything, we learned about all of this, so we're less embarrassed, but now I just embarrassed us. And let's see, so then Wegener solved that problem, and then Grunbaum was the first person to sort of realize all of these discoveries, and he wrote a survey and gave his own proof. And then Godfrey Toussaint, he was in our group that rediscovered it, and then we learned of Grunbaum's paper. He came up with yet another proof and summarized all the past results in a bunch of related problems. So this is the story, and the theorem was lost in discovery, discovered many times, and it's sort of cool. So when I taught my folding class, it's like, oh, this is a theorem everyone should know. And so I sort of gave this history, and then I wanted to cover a proof. And so which proof do you choose? Well, the latest and greatest, right? So here is the latest and greatest proof, and I'm not going to give all the details, but just give you the high-level picture. So you have some polygon, and you suppose that you can flip it infinitely many times, and you never get a convex polygon. So there are three steps to the proof. One is to show that that infinite sequence has a limit, then to show that the limit is convex. And this is actually really easy, because if you take this limiting of this infinite process, if it wasn't convex, then you weren't done. You had another flip that you could make. Okay? And then finally, you look at this convex limit, and you show that the vertices have to get close to the limit, and once they're sufficiently close, you're done after finitely many steps. Okay. Unfortunately, this proof is wrong. So it's great, because I saw lots of people nodding their head at the wrong step. I won't embarrass who was. Yeah, this is false. That's the only one I gave details for. In particular, there's this issue. When you have multiple pockets, you may imagine you spend infinite time dealing with this pocket over here. And so you do this infinite sequence, and you do eventually maybe convexify that portion, because then you're sort of done. But maybe you never even touch this pocket. It just sits there. So the limit is not necessarily convex, or it's not obvious. I mean, none of these things exist, so it's a little hard to say whether this is true or false, but the proof is wrong. So that's kind of annoying, and I didn't notice this. I was proving the theorem on the blackboard with the students, and then someone raises their hand and like, that's step two. I don't understand why that's correct. They're very polite. And so thinking about it, like, maybe it isn't. And so the next class, so over the weekend, we're friends with Gottfried, and so I emailed Gottfried over the weekend. It's like, there seems to be a problem here. What should we do? And so we dig out Nagy's proof. That's like the old, you know, it's really cool. We're going back to 1939, you know, back in the day. This is how proofs were done, you know. And we're really excited. And so we all read the proof together. This is with Joe O'Rourke at the time. And over the weekend via email, of course. And it's like, oh, the proof is almost the same. Because Toussaint's proof was based on Grunbaum's proof, which is in turn based on Nagy's proof. So we went back to the source. And so they're very similar. They have the same structure of prove there's a limit, prove there's convex, and then argue that you're done when you're near the limit. And the only one that really differed, the only problem we had was with the arguing the limit is convex. And this is a beautiful argument. Okay, you have this polygon. When you flip it, it gets bigger. So the new thing is contained in the old thing. And so you have this containment chain that as you flip your polygon, this is an actual example where you get lots and lots of flips out of a single quadrilateral. And now I want to take the convex hulls of each of these guys. So those are also nested, the convex hull of the first polygon is inside the convex hull of the next polygon, because you're always getting bigger. And then you show this nesting relation that your polygon is contained in the convex hull, and when you flip a pocket out, the new polygon contains the original convex hull, and so these guys are sort of interwoven. And now you want to take the limit of these guys, the P's, the polygons, and you could also take the limit of the convex guys, and they have to go to the same thing by this containment relation. So therefore, the limit is convex. Yeah, this only works if you flip all the pockets simultaneously. This is false. Because if you have two pockets again, you only flip one of them, the original hull is not contained in the new thing. You'd have to flip all the pockets. So it's funny, because Nagy was the one who pointed out that you shouldn't do all the pockets at once, and yet he made the same mistake. So this, if you did flip all pockets, this would be a proof. But if you flip them one at a time, it doesn't work. So, of course, we didn't realize this over the weekend. So I was presenting this in class, and like, oh, this is so cool. And then the same student raises his hand. And then we draw this counterexample. So the next class, I got it right. I don't remember what happened. Anyway, we ended up writing a paper about it. That's what happened. This is the critical moment in Nash's proof. Each polygon in the sequence, blah, 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 contains, obviously, the foregoing ones in its interior. So, lesson for those who use the word obviously. And it's actually, this may have been known. It's a little hard to tell. Maybe I should ask these guys. But in this 1961 paper, there's this quote, if you read Russian. This is, I think, an English translation. Proof of this theorem given by Nash is incorrect. And then Grunbaum actually noticed that. He also reads Russian, and he said, they remarked that Nash's proof is invalid. This is like the last sentence of the paper. But they don't say why. And so they may have known why, but they didn't say why. And then it took us till 2004 or 5 before we noticed again. Oh, interesting. Yeah. Right, so Grunbaum thought it was correct. I mean, he based the proof on it, so he simplified the proof in some sense, so he thought it was correct, too. I mean, sorry to embarrass people here, but so it is. So we went through all of the proofs, and it turns out a lot of them are wrong, but not all of them. So the theorem is still true. This is comforting, but it's kind of interesting. It's convenient that there are so many independent rediscoveries because we got several independent attempts at correct proofs. So Reshetnyak was the first correct one. Kazarnov and Bing was also correct. They do mention a conjecture which turns out to be false, but hey, it's a conjecture. That's okay. Epsilon imprecise. You know, it's a little bit. It skips a few steps, but it's decent. This one's also kind of a little terse. I mean, we're just complaining, but they're correct, I would say. we apply a very strict mentality here because there's so many things you can do wrong. You can say, and the limit is convex. If you don't justify that claim, it's not really a proof because everyone's got it wrong.
What's the theory? Yeah. Because if you don't live alternatively, you have two choices.
So the theorem is that no matter which sequence of flips you choose, all of them have finite convergence. Good question. So Grunbaum proved a weaker theorem, which is if I choose the flip that maximizes the area each time, then that one will converge after finite time. So he has special proofs. He also skipped one of the key steps that people get wrong. So it's not technically incorrect, but it's an omission. The other proofs, well, in particular, the two correct proofs are about no matter which flip sequence you choose, you're guaranteed finiteness. So, you know, just to add to the pile, we added our own proof. It's about a page and a half. And let's see. Do people want to hear how it works? Some people do. All right. I'm going to just sketch it quickly, graphically. So there's three main steps and then a sort of punchline. So I'm going to go quickly, and if you're a mathematician, hopefully you'll follow. Otherwise, you can tune out for a second. So the first thing is to show that everything's expansive. You know what that means? So if you look at a vertex and you flip it above, so this is a pocket, the blue thing, and you flip it above this lid, so the vertex goes up there. If you look at some vertex inside the polygon, the distance increases by a triangle inequality, or because this is a Voronoi diagram. Okay, so that's an easy thing. If you look at a fixed point, all the vertices are getting farther away from that point. They also can't get too far, no more than twice the perimeter, or half the perimeter. Yeah, half the perimeter. So they can't get too far, so it's monotone and bounded, so it has a limit. So distances have a limit. So now I take three points in general position inside the original polygon. They'll stay inside the polygon by monotonicity. And so any vertex has to converge. Each of the distances from these three points converges, so the point has to converge to the intersection of those three circles, which is unique. These are in general position. So you get convergence. This is how you prove that there's a limit polygon. Now you want to prove that it's convex. We don't need to do that directly. The other thing to notice is that when you flip a polygon, so originally the pink is a polygon, and this is a reflex vertex, angle more than 180. When you flip it, it becomes convex. So now it's less than 180. And so every time you move an angle, it alternates between convex and reflex. So you can, because the vertices converge, you can show that the angles converge. So there's some limit angle. If you have a vertex that flips infinitely often, the limit angle has to be 180 because it jumps between bigger than 1D, less than 1D. So it has to converge to flat. So any vertex that moves infinitely often converges to flat. So let's look at the non-flat angles. Eventually, those stop moving. And the non-flat angles are the only things that determine your convex hull. Flat angles don't change the convex hull. And so if you look at the limit, the convex hull, sort of, it only cares about the non-flat vertices, and after finite time, those guys have gotten where they need to go. And so nothing else can happen. You're done. You can't leave the convex hull, so you can't do any more flips. So that was a quick sketch, but it's actually pretty easy if you get it right. And this is very close to, I think, Reshetnyak's proof. I forget. Well, every time it flips, it goes outside. So you're thinking about a guy that goes infinitely often? So it's gonna converge to flat. Because there's a limit polygon, there has to be a limit angle for that vertex. And so the limit angle is one thing, not two things. Right? I mean, it has a unique limit. The vertices have a unique limit, and so you can use that. I didn't prove that, but the angles have a unique limit also. So it can't have two limit points. So the unique limit has to be 180. But once the other guys have stopped moving, you're supposed to be flat already, basically. If you flip, you go outside and you destroy the hull. It shouldn't happen. Okay. Sorry, it's a little quick. I want to move on to other topics. You can also think about what happens if you allow the polygons to intersect themselves, if initially they intersect themselves. There's a little open problem here. When you're allowed to intersect yourself, the interesting things become these hairpin vertices where the angle is 0 or 360. And if you forbid them, then this always works. If you allow them, sometimes you get stuck and you can go on forever. And there's an open problem exactly when this happens. But I want to move on to the next topic, modern mathematics. These are problems posed around the time I was alive. That's my definition of modern. Sorry. So this is one of the places I got started in this world of linkages. Many of you know it, but I'll jump to the newer and interesting stuff in a moment. So this general problem, I have a linkage, I want to know, and here we're thinking usually about chains, about building some structure out of a string of material, maybe wire or a tube or a robotic arm. I want to know, can I get from every configuration to every configuration? Maybe I start with this nice string of wire. Can I bend it up into any 3D shape? Is that always possible? And here we're not allowed to collide because material can't go through itself. So when is this possible? The answer depends what dimension you live in. If you live in two dimensions, you can always take a chain or a polygon and make it straight or make it convex. That's the Carpenter's rule theorem. In 3D, you can't always do this, and in 4D and higher, you can always do this. So and intuitively, this happens because there are knots in 3D, but there are no knots in 2D or 4D. So that's in case you're not familiar with that area. So one fun problem is now we know that you can move from here to here. How do you do this algorithmically? What's a nice way to fold a robotic arm or fold a piece of wire into some 2D shape? And one of my favorite methods is with a knot theorist and two graphics people. Originally, the idea came from graphics, which is kind of cool. You define an energy function that intuitively says you have this polygon. Everything is electrostatically charged, and every edge repels every other edge. And then so everything tries to fly away from each other simultaneously. You just see what happens by gradient flow. And this has some nice features. It's smooth. It's easy to compute. You could even build this in principle, although we've never actually built a physical, like not implement it on a computer, but implement it in real life, the physics model of computer. And you can prove a pseudo-polynomial time-bound. This is the only algorithm known to achieve this, although the time-bound that we prove is fairly weak, I'll admit. It's n to the 125 times r to the 41. This is my limit. It's not the highest polynomial time bound, I'm sad to report, but it's my personal best at the highest bound. N is the number of vertices. R is the ratio of the longest distance to the smallest distance. I think you need a dependence on N and R maybe even polynomial, but I'm sure these are not the best exponents. Blah, blah, blah. Okay, so I'll just show you what it looks like. If you know what an expansive motion is, these are not expansive, but they're kind of expansive on average, because everything gets averaged together, and then we're just playing the motion backwards. That was taking this teeth example, which some people had conjectured didn't unfold back before we knew Carpenter's rule theorem. This is also an old example. Here we're preserving the five-fold rotational symmetry. We're zooming out as this happens, as it unfolds. So they look cool. Here's a bigger one, I think 500 vertices, just to show. I think this takes a couple of minutes to compute. It's pretty fast. It's faster than the n to the 125 r to the 81. As is typical in kind of gradient flow, you can prove a very weak bound, but in practice it works pretty well. And this is a Halloween theme, so we've got the spider and the tentacle. So that's energy flow. You can use this for other things too. So here's a problem of, I give you not just one polygon, but two polygons. I want to go from A to B directly. So this is polygon B, and this is polygon A over here. And I want to try to find the direct route from A to B instead of unfolding and then refolding. So this is polygon morphing. And this is a little harder to prove things about. Let me skip over some things. So we can't prove that these motions are good, but we can compute them. Essentially, what's going on here is you have two points in this energy landscape. You want to go from A to B. You try to go directly. What if I just interpolate either the angles or the vertex coordinates? Doesn't matter too much. I think here we're using vertex coordinates. So try to go straight there. But if that increases energy, change your direction a little bit so that you don't increase energy. And so in the worst case, you'll fall all the way down the hill. And it's sort of similar thing. Here we have this is the flying to Canada animation, I guess. We'll go from maple leaf to an airplane. Here the lengths are not the same in A and B, so we're allowing them to change, but only monotonically. Got to only increase or only decrease each length. You have these two points. You try to go straight. If you can't, you sort of round to the nearest not energy increasing motion, and it gets pretty nice motions. They're a little wiggly at times, but it's kind of fun because, let's see. Oh, this is a good one. This is, well, those transformers. We go from Autobots to Decepticons, or vice versa, I forget which is which. And jump to the end here. Literally. I think every morphing video has to end with that. So it's fun. We're using the theory to find these motions, but this is not as theoretically grounded as the unfolding stuff. All right. Let me tell you a little bit about trees. This is actually I think the first paper I wrote about linkage folding was with this example. So instead of having a chain, like a robotic arm or a polygon, you allow vertices with more than two things attached to them. Then you can find an example that's locked. It can't really move much at all. And we had a somewhat tedious proof of that. And this had one vertex here. It has degree 8. You can go down to degree 5 in this example, but the question was, can you do it with one vertex of degree 3 only, and everything else is a chain? And this is an example with Bob and Gunther. One vertex of degree 3, and then chains hanging off of that, and it doesn't look locked, but if you make these distances really small, it is actually stuck. And there's maybe one other example of a locked tree, but I started wondering recently, actually, in the context of my folding class, with these open problem sessions. And so a fun problem was, can we do it with fewer edges? Do we need, you can count how many edges are in each of these. It's a fair number, at least this one's, I guess, minimum of 15. Can you do it with fewer? And luckily, we came up with a smaller example, but let me just jump to that. So we came up with 11 edges. This is an interesting example. It's almost flat, And so it's a little hard to draw. I added curved edges, but really they're straight. And all of these edges are basically the same length. And we want to think of all the circle means that all these vertices are almost on top of each other, and those vertices are almost on top of each other. So the whole thing is almost collinear. And in fact, you can think of them as being on top of each other, and then it will actually be rigid. It can't move at all. And then there's this theorem with Bob and Gunter again that when everything's touching, it's rigid, then even when you space things out a little bit, they still can't move very much. It can only move epsilon. Okay, so that's cool. 11 edges was kind of nice, and then we started simplifying it, and we got down to 10 edges, and it's a little uglier, which started simplifying it. We got to 9 edges, and like, oh man, this is so nice and symmetric. It's only 2 degree 3 vertices, but okay, this has got to be the optimum. How many people think this is the optimum? No one, because I set you up. So in fact, this is the optimum. It's 8 edges. This one only has 1 degree 3 vertex, but it's nice and small, and it's actually a really easy way to prove that it's locked or rigid. And it uses these rules that were introduced for a different reason in this paper with Bob and others. That these two rules 1 and 2, these are very cool. I like them. So imagine you have 2 edges that are the same length, exactly. Okay, and one of them is sort of wedged against the other in that this angle is convex and this angle is convex, strictly less than 90, both of these. Then for positive time, this thing can't move at all. It's wedged against there. These would have to open to at least 90 degrees before you can move out. And so if you just want to know, can it move at all, you can fuse those edges together. And there's a similar picture here where you have 2 edges that share a vertex. And if this is less than 90, then for positive time, these have to be wedged against each other so you can just redraw it like that. And so in this picture, you can apply rule 2 here, because this edge is of the same length and wedged against this one. There's 2 angles of 0, actually, the top and bottom. And so those are basically 1 edge, and then also over here, they're basically 1 edge. And at this point, this is a rule 2, so you can wedge those together. And now you have 2 triangles joined in an edge, and that's rigid. Done. So this, while original lock trees were really painful to prove locked, this is really easy. Cool. Another problem is, can you do it with all the edge lengths the same? There's a motivation for this in protein folding, which I'll get to later. And there's this example, which is almost all the edges are almost the same length. And if you're allowed to touch yourself, sounds bad, then you can make these all equal length. But if you really want positive gaps here, they can't all be exactly the same length. But we found an example that does have all the edges the same length. This is tedious to prove again because nothing's touching. But it works. Okay, and enough about trees. Here's another fun thing to do. Instead of thinking about these thin one-dimensional chains, what if you had blocks, polygons, that are hinged together? Well, then you can, even with triangles, you can make things that are locked. These things can't unfold. And these are actually old examples from the beginning of our folding by my dad. And let's see. We're going to think of these as chains, which we know how to unfold in 2 dimensions, but then think of attachments, adornments, attached to that chain. And so these are sort of bad attachments. And what could be better than an equilateral triangle? But nonetheless, you have these barbs, and things get stuck. So we started wondering, well, what if we attach something other than equilateral triangles? Can we unfold something? And there's this theorem that if you have something called a slender adornment, which you can define in a few different ways. But these are all examples of slender things. So it turns out equilateral triangle is too big, but a right triangle, with that being the right angle attached to an edge, that's okay. And anything that sort of stays near this line, the formal definitions are up there, you proceed monotonically from one vertex to the other, those are all good. And in fact, this is a slender adornment. It looks pretty giant, but it's okay. That's the Reuleaux triangle, or sort of. Cool. Now this is a fun theorem, and this is actually where rules 1 and 2 were originally introduced, and you can use it to prove other things. So for example, in hinged dissection. So this is an old result. I guess it finally got published in 2005, but the conference version was in 99, I think. So this was, here's a chain of right triangles, and the theorem was it had a folded state in any polyomino. So these are shapes made out of 16 squares. These are all 16 ominos. And if you take 32 right triangles joined like this, we prove that it exists in this folded state, and it exists in this folded state, in any 16 omino, and this works for any value of 16. That's the general theorem. But we didn't know about continuous motions to get from one of these to the other. But this is a slender adorned chain, and so we get that this can fold into anything that it has as a folded state, so you can actually do this continuously without some intersection. So that's comforting, a sort of retroactive result. And here's a fun hinge dissection. This is an alphabet, and it's again made out of right triangles, but not quite in the slender way. This is not a slender adorned chain. So I don't know whether this can fold continuously from the letter A to the letter B to the letter C, or F to I to E to L, whatever. So this is like an art project, but I don't know whether we don't have an animation here because I don't know if it exists without the stuff intersection. But to the rescue is this approach. This is by Zach Abel, who many of you have met here. You take any hinge dissection, you can carve it up into three times as many pieces, such that all the pieces are slender adornments. It's not hard. And once you have that, you can continuously fold this into anything that the original hinge dissection could make. And we use that to prove this theorem, which is that hinge dissections exist. Any five polygons of equal area, there's one chain of pieces that can fold into each of those polygons and continuously without self-intersection. And just to give you a flavor of what that looks like, this is the again, Zach's big idea. If you have some way of hinging pieces together and you'd like to change it to hinge things differently, turns out you can just sort of move this orange piece up to that B prime. You can do it by subdividing everything into this chain of pieces, and then you can fold that chain either into this configuration or this configuration. Repeat this many times, and you can move any piece anywhere, and you can show that anything can be hinge dissected. It's pretty cool. Now, this would not work without self-intersection, but then you subdivide it three times as many pieces, and it can fold. Okay. I want to go to 3D. So 3D things are harder because of examples like this, like two long knitting needles joined with a very short string. And intuitively, this is knotted, although if this was made entirely of string, you could undo it. But because of these long, rigid bars, you cannot undo it, and so this configuration is locked. We still don't have a nice characterization of which 3D chains are locked. This probably isn't one, because in general, figuring out whether a chain can be reconfigured from one shape to another is really hard, space complete. And I'm not going to show you that proof, but I wanted to show you some of the constructions because they look cool. Instead of looking at one linkage that's locked, you can think about chains that by themselves are not locked, but when you interweave them, they can't be separated. These are called interlocked chains. And so the smallest example is a three chain, this purple one, that interlocks with the four chain, the green one. Four edges, three edges. Now, so that's using a four chain. What if you have no four chains? Because the smallest individually locked chain has five edges. It turns out you can do it with three chains. It's kind of cool. Nice and symmetric. And if you don't have any three chain, well, you only have one. Wow, okay. Enough about interlocks. I'm going to go to, it's a little particular. I want to talk a little bit about protein folding and reconfigurable robotics and nanomanufacturing. These are what I've been working on lately. So protein folding is this big challenge. Proteins fold into their nice 3D shapes very quickly, relatively quickly. We don't exactly know how. The question is how. Proteins are the fundamental building block of life. They make life happen. So we'd like to know what shapes they make, because the geometry determines a lot about what that protein does. And through the, too early in the morning. You can translate easily from your DNA into a protein. That's a known code, the genetic code. That's what I'm thinking of. And so we know the one-dimensional structure, but then we don't know what 3D form it makes a lot of the time. People are doing experiments to find out, but it takes a long time. Hard to do. So people try to understand protein folding, and there's sort of two approaches I want to distinguish. The usual approach is to figure out how nature folds proteins, and this is partly a modeling question, an optimization question. It's hard. And because it's hard and well-studied, I ignore it, not entirely. But I like to think about this other approach, which is the more mechanical approach. Think about if you were designing nature and you knew some basic geometry about what proteins look like, how they move mechanically, how would you set up a system so that they fold well? And this is a more geometric problem and a more algorithmic problem, so it's more within my expertise. And there's some interesting things you could say that maybe suggest hypotheses for what nature is doing that you could then try to prove in real life. But it's definitely a little farther away from the real world. Okay, so here's the geometry of a protein. You've got a bunch of atoms, and they're connected by these atomic bonds. And the angles are fixed. You see these red angles. They're mostly fixed. And these are the measured values. These are the distances, 1.33 angstroms. It's tiny stuff. And so we think of this basically as a fixed angle linkage, meaning not only are the edges fixed, but also the angles are fixed. So you're not allowed to do this. All you can do is spin around one edge. And it's a tree, actually, in structure, but it's almost a chain. So there's basically one big chain called the backbone, and there's little things hanging off. If you ignore those, it's like a chain. And the challenge here, so the weird thing, is that we know mathematically, mechanically even, it's really hard to fold chains. It's piece-based complete to fold a chain from one shape to another in 3D. 2D, we know how to do it, but 3D is really hard. So how in the world does nature do it so easily? Maybe evolution just made it easy. But maybe there's some extra structure in the nature world, in the real world, that makes this possible. So here's two hypotheses. One possible answer, proteins have some additional geometric structure. In particular, the edge lengths are all, if you look at all these edge lengths, they're all within about 15% of each other. Certainly within a factor of two. And the only example we know that's locked has a 3-to-1 ratio. So there's one edge that's three times longer than the others. So maybe there are no proteins like that. Edges are closer because that makes it easier to fold. We don't know whether there's a locked chain where all the bars have roughly the same length. This has been open for a long time. When you add fixed angles, that becomes possible. But in this situation, not only are there fixed angles, but all the angles are about the same and they're all obtuse. And in that situation, again, we don't know whether there are any locked chains. It's a cool open problem. Okay, so this is what we would like to prove, but we don't know how to. A different constraint on the geometry of proteins is that they're built by this machine called the ribosome, which is made up of various proteins and proteases and so on. And so there's the protein. This is a machine for converting your DNA into proteins. And as it builds the protein, it starts spewing out of the machine over here and starts folding, presumably. Haven't seen this happen. So when it's folding, there's this big machine in the way. And so if you're a geometer, you look at it and say, well, it's a big machine. It's really big. So it's an obstacle. When you're folding, presumably you're sort of within a relatively small space here. There's a big flat wall here. You cannot penetrate the wall. So as you're folding, you work in a half space. That may seem like a pretty weak constraint, but it's enough to prove some pretty interesting things. We model the ribosome as a cone, but in reality, it's more like a half space. We can handle that case. We're just a little more general. And so the model is your protein is spewing out the top here. It starts folding. As long as it doesn't collide with the cone, we can prove that everything you can build can then be folded into anything else that you can build. So this is sort of a universality result. You can go between any two states that are producible. You can flatten them. And there's a canonical, instead of going to a straight configuration because all the angles are fixed here, we go to a canonical helical configuration, which looks a lot like reality. So maybe there's an algorithm here that tells you how to fold producible protein chains, as we call them. Maybe that's the algorithm that nature is somehow implementing using energetics and helpers and so on. Okay. I want to say a little bit about energetics. This is more to be, I don't know, controversial. I have this question, does nature minimize energy? Most people think yes. So you define, so a lot of work is in defining what energy function is it minimizing. I don't believe that nature can minimize energy because it's NP-complete most of the time. So it's computationally intractable, and I don't believe nature can do more than a computer. That's the controversial part. Probably it's finding a local minimum, and maybe evolution has designed things to be, it's where local and global minima coincide. That seems a little tricky to do, though. I mean, nature's had a lot of time, but still, solving NP-complete problems over time is hard. So, maybe you can design proteins easier than you can actually fold them. So maybe that's what nature did by evolution. And there's lots of interesting questions here. I want to move on to, I'll mute the volume, transformers, and you know what this is? Terminator 2, yeah. The liquid metal robot, T-1000. So I like science fiction, and I want to build these things. I want to build the something that can go between a car and a humanoid, why not? And I really want to build this, which is metal that can totally change its shape. And this, I was talking about some of this yesterday, but here's a different approach, is to build it out of hinge dissections. So this is more like the transformers where you go from one shape to another shape. So here's a classic hinge dissection of a square into an equilateral triangle. This is a centimeter, so it's not so small, but this is kind of cool in that these things are slightly out of plane, and you add a little bit of salt to this liquid that it's floating on, and it reconfigures to here. So this is a way that chemically you can actuate a hinge dissection. And we know hinge dissections can make anything, at least in two dimensions. So maybe we can use this to build transformers. Okay, that's one theory. You can also generalize things to 3D. This is an older result for the three-dimensional case. Just making, if you want to make shapes made out of little cubes, like I was doing with the self-folding sheets yesterday, there's a hinge dissection of a lot of little cubes that can fold into anything of larger cubes. And we use this to build a sculpture out of 1,000 blocks, but you can also use it to actually build robots. This is not an actuated robot, this is just a 3D printed model. And here's an actual robot. This one's about this big, so like meter diameter. It's actually being manually controlled here by someone who's putting wires together to turn the motors. It looks like it's automatic, it's very impressive. And this is a very small example, but it's a hinge dissection, and you could, in principle, if you make a really long chain, it could fold like a protein into any 3D shape you want. So a little bit slower than the T-1000, but you have to start somewhere. Here's another one. This one is about, I think, 10 meters in diameter, so this is trying to scale things up, make it even bigger. It's a little bit slower because of all the weight, but it's a longer chain, and so you get a sense that this is a stairwell, how much, what kind of shapes it can fold into, and this one is automatically controlled, so there's little CPUs in each of the units deciding when to turn various times. So this is with at the Media Lab, or the Center for Bits and Atoms. All right, so that's different approaches to making hinge dissections that could fold, in principle, anything. But this is, in some sense, already being done with proteins and with DNA, and a different approach that's started in particular by Paul Rothman in 2006, this Nature paper, is to take DNA as like a big, you could think of it as a hinge dissection, that's how I think of it, biologists maybe don't, and think about, well, can I get it to fold into some shape that I want? This is one really long chain, and I really like it to fold into this shape because it looks like a happy face, and I'd like to be happy. So you can do it. I'm not going to go into the details exactly how, but you build extra little pieces of DNA that sort of make little glues here, and magically nature finds the right way to glue them together most of the time. It doesn't always make a perfect happy face, but it makes a whole bunch of them. Mass production, and this is super tiny. I mean, the feature size here is, 10 nanometers or something? Very, very small. So this is an approach to making things at the really nano scale, like a T-1000. And this is the original paper and all the different shapes it can make. It made different kinds of triangles, and actually there are a few other things. He made a map of the United States, And it's pretty cool what you can do. And this is the idea. This is called DNA origami. That was the term. I was actually brought in as a sub-referee just to determine whether DNA origami was a valid term for this thing. I said, sure, why not? And by now, everyone uses the term DNA origami, and they fold all sorts of crazy things. This is one more recent paper by William Shee's group, 2009, to make 3D things. It's a little hard to look at 3D things, and you can see the fidelity of these pictures is not as beautiful because it's using different technology for imaging. But you're building an icosahedron, actually, by making little DNA tile, different portions that glue together, and nature finds the right way to glue them together, and you look at it from different angles, it looks right. You can build other weird 3D structures. I think these are out of individual DNA strands. So I think this is really powerful, and this is sort of where the field is going. How do we build arbitrary 3D structures by folding linkages, essentially, which are strands of DNA, into interesting structures, and then using those to assemble larger and larger interesting things? That's something I've been working on lately, but I'm out of time, so that's all for today. Thanks.